From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the cinematic quality of violence. We talk with Brian De Palma, director of the films Carrie, Dressed to Kill, Scarface, and Casualties of War. His new film, Carlito's Way, stars Al Pacino and Sean Penn. Also, what older comic has now reappeared on a young comic's hit TV show? Hint, the two comics have the same first name. We talk with Jerry Stiller, who now has a recurring role on Seinfeld, as George's father. And linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us about Somalia's oral culture. Its written language is only 20 years old. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Pentagon has found no link between chemical weapons agents reportedly used during the Persian Gulf War and health problems suffered by Gulf War veterans. The detections were reported by Czechoslovakian chemical warfare detachments deployed with Saudi Arabian forces. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports from the Pentagon.
The U.S. sent a team of experts to Prague last month to assess the Czech detection procedures. Secretary Les Aspin announced today that the team concluded the Czech report is valid, but found no way now to confirm the detections. Aspin said it was unlikely agents came from an Iraqi attack, but could not rule out the possibility. Secretary Aspin also said the Czech detections were not responsible for health problems in U.S. vets.
Given the date and concentrations detected, our findings to date establish no linkage between the detections reported by the Czechs and the illness reported by some of the veterans.
Aspin says this report is a first step. A further study will be conducted to double-check the findings. I'm Martha Raddatz at the Pentagon.
A bipartisan group of senators has proposed a package of $109 billion in additional federal spending cuts. The savings would be over and above the cuts already recommended by President Clinton and enacted in August, and the plan includes no tax increases. The biggest single saving in the Senate plan, more than $26 billion, would come from cutting the federal workforce by 252,000 workers over a five-year period. The plan would raise more than $16 billion by requiring high-income retirees to pay the full monthly premium for their Medicare coverage. In Mexico, commentators on last night's debate between Vice President Gore and Ross Perot had little to say today about Perot's attacks on Mexico's political system. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
Last night's debate has been played down here today on Mexican TV, which is closely aligned with the government. The face-off was not the lead story on most newscasts this morning. There was strong agreement among those commenting on TV about the debate, though, that Vice President Gore made a much better showing than did Ross Perot. Virtually nothing was reported about Perot's broadsides last night against Mexican authorities, in which he accused them of running a one-party system that violates human rights and suppresses wages. One commentator simply asserted that whatever the Vice President and Ross Perot may have to say, and whatever the U.S. Congress may decide about NAFTA, Mexico will in no way be affected. Only the small elite here that subscribes to cable TV had direct access to the debate. There are no plans for a similar debate on NAFTA here in Mexico. I'm David Wellner in Mexico City.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 23 points today to close at 3,664. This is NPR. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has fired two State Department aides who were accused of attempting to read the confidential personnel files of staffers from the Bush administration. Spokesman Michael McCurry told reporters that the two men, political appointees, fired were Mark Schulhoff, an assistant to the department's public affairs chief, and Joseph Tarver, who worked in the office of White House liaison. Arrests in Macedonia today raised ethnic tensions in that southern Balkan republic. A government official and six others were detained in connection with plotting a rebellion, according to radio reports from the Macedonian capital. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from London.
Macedonia's interior minister confirmed the arrest today. However, the official account of the charges remains unclear. It appears that at least 7 men were arrested. 2 are deputy ministers in the government. All of the arrested are ethnic Albanians. According to reports from the Macedonian capital, the men may be charged with organizing a paramilitary organization recruited from members of a legal political party that represents Macedonia's ethnic Albanians. Macedonia's population is said to be around 20% ethnic Albanian, but the Albanians there claim it's closer to 40%, and many of those say they want to be united with neighboring Albania. The arrest today is likely to raise tensions in one of the only republics of the former Yugoslavia that reached independence without war. Last June, 300 American peacekeepers joined a Scandinavian deployment of UN Blue Helmets to try to keep the war in the Balkans from spilling over into Macedonia. In London, this is Deborah Amos.
The Commandant of the Marine Corps offered an apology today for saying that minority officers don't perform as well as whites do on certain tasks. On CBS's 60 Minutes program, General Carl Mundy had said that statistics show minority officers don't shoot, swim, or use compasses as well as whites. Mundy said today that those comments were not the thoughts of my mind and they are not the thoughts of my heart. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Brian De Palma is the kind of director who evokes strong reactions. Pauline Kael has praised him for his seductive, virtuosic control of film craft, which enables him to express even what is in the unconscious. Others have condemned De Palma for excessive use of violence. De Palma's movies include Carrie, Dressed to Kill, The Untouchables, Scarface, Casualties of War, and Bonfire of the Vanities. His new film, Carlito's Way, stars Al Pacino as a former drug dealer just out of prison trying to start a new life. Sean Penn plays his coked-up lawyer. The film climaxes with a chase scene, which New York Times film critic Janet Maslin describes as a sequence Hitchcock might have envied. Pacino is being pursued up and down the stairs and escalators of New York's Grand Central Station. But that wasn't the initial idea for the scene.
Originally, what happened was somebody threw a bomb in his car, and that's how he got hurt. And I felt to make this very cinematic, we needed sort of a 100-yard dash to the finish line. And in Manhattan, a 100-yard dash on the streets, on the subways, in the train stations. And a lot of things happened that I couldn't predict, like the first sequence was set up so that he would go down the stairs, the escalator in the World Trade Center. But unfortunately, the World Trade Center was bombed.
Instead of his car.
Exactly. So I had to completely find another way to do this because there's a fantastic escalator in the World Trade Center that's immensely long, and I had this very complicated scene all mapped out, and then I had to sort of toss it out the window and come up with something. He was originally going to a plane, but I found airports are not too cinematically interesting, so when I started to wander around Grand Central Station, I could see I could make this all work in one location and have him get on a train instead of a plane.
If I understood this correctly, you were actually kind of in a shootout once yourself when you were like 22. And would you describe the story?
Oh, I guess college hijinks, I guess, basically. I was feeling very depressed and I had too much to drink. And I stole a motor scooter and ran a few lights. And a policeman pulled me over and I knocked him down and took off, and they ran me off and shot me.
Okay, so you knocked. How did you knock down the officer?
With my fists, as I recall.
So where were you shot?
The leg.
Now, was there a sensation that you experienced during that shootout that you've tried in after that to capture in films? Was it anything like?
Well, that's a sort of an interesting question because, you know, we're constantly assailed with questions about violence in cinema and, you know, and what is this doing to the people that are watching it? And anybody that's been in any kind of truly violent situation, there's no analogy at all. The thing about movies are they're very much in control and very safe as you experience the situations. When you're in a violent situation, chaos and you never know it's going to happen, and things happen so fast that, and it's a completely different sensation. There's absolutely no correlation. I'm always continually amazed by these questions about the what violence in cinema has to do with, you know, creating violence in the world that the people see when they go to the movie theaters, and there's no correlation at all.
Now, you spent the night in prison that night. Were you the only suburban kid in your area?
No, this happened on 11th Street. I was here in New York.
Oh, okay. Right.
It's a great experience to be in the tank. You have a healthy respect for law enforcement and what they're trying to do, and you never want to go back.
Strong visual images that stayed with you from that night in prison?
Loss of freedom, something that very few of us experience. You have to be arrested and thrown in the tank to really have a sense of you're just a number at the bottom of a list. And who you are and where you come from means nothing.
Brian De Palma is my guest. His new movie is Carlito's Way. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your background and get into how you started being interested in movies. You were raised in Philadelphia. Your father was an orthopedic surgeon.
Yes.
So did he take you to operations?
Yes, I spent a few summers observing operations.
Now, some people get really squeamish when they see that, and other people are absolutely fascinated by it. What was your reaction?
I was kind of fascinated. I was, you know, very interested in science. I'm a science fair winner in the Franklin Institute for many years. And I had a very kind of scientific eye on it. I'm a very good person to have around in an accident. In the sense that, you know, blood and, you know, people being hurt doesn't faze me at all.
Unless you're getting shot.
Yes, unless it's me. But, no, it was really quite interesting. It's nice. Followed him around on his rounds at Jefferson when I was, you know, 16, 17, 18.
You know, I should tell you that many years ago, like in the mid-70s or something, I interviewed your brother, your scientist brother, physicist, I believe. So, you know, my show comes out of Philadelphia, and it was local then, and I think he was living in Bucks County.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a theory of anti-gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Has he proven it yet?
He's still working on it. I haven't seen the thing lift off yet, so maybe in the future.
And am I remembering correctly that he had something to do with the invention of 3D glasses polarized lenses?
That's right. When he was working for the Polaroid company, he was perfecting a 3D system.
Hmm. So did his interest in science have an influence on you?
Absolutely. He was very influential. He was an electrical engineer and a physicist, so. And he won a science fair, and then I won a science fair. It's a little sibling rivalry.
Okay, one other high school-type question here. You were on all the prom committees, and you really don't seem like the type to be planning the sophomore and junior proms.
Well, I tried to fit in when I was in high school. I was one of those people that could hang out with the jocks on the football team and also be on the chess team. I straddled both worlds.
So did all your prom experience come in handy when you were making Carrie?
Yes, 50s proms, indeed.
You knew all about it?
And a very important event in all our lives, going to the prom.
I have to say that one of my favorite shots of yours is in Carrie. And I haven't seen in the movie in a few years, so I might get this a little bit wrong, but when she's crowned queen of the prom right before they dump the bucket of blood on her, because mm-hmm. the whole thing's really they're just making fun of her, the camera has this like delirious swing around the room, circling around her.
The famous stuffing of the ballot box shot.
What do you mean stuffing of the ballot box?
It starts with
with the stuffing of the ballot when they're voting, yeah.
When they take the real ballots and supplied them with the fixed ballots. It's a crane. It's a long crane shot. It's a, like a 180-degree crane shot that starts at Carrie's table and goes over to the side, where you see them exchanging, taking out the ballots they had collected and dumping them on the floor and putting in the phony ballots. Then they walk over and give them to Betty Buckley, who's one of the teachers, and she's counting them. And then the camera goes by the steps, and you see Nancy Allen down there with John Travolta, giggling with glee. And then you follow the rope all the way up to the top that takes you over the bucket of blood, and then you zoom back to them at the table as they win the counting of the ballots and are elected by one vote.
Was that very hard to do?
Yes. Took all day to do it.
Well, how did you go from being very absorbed in science to being so absorbed in movies?
I left Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. I left the influence of my older brother, who was the physics genius, and I came to Columbia in New York and suddenly found that I was interested in other things besides science.
You were surprised to find that out?
Well, I always had these ideas, these stories. I knew a lot about cinematography because I was a kind of a science type, knew about how cameras worked. And at Columbia, they wouldn't let undergraduates direct plays, so the only thing left to me was to get into the movies. So I hawked all my science fair winnings and bought a Bolex.
Was there a point that you knew this was it, that filmmaking was it for you?
I just went from science to making movies and never looked back.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that you hawked your science stuff for your first Bolex. So how were you changed by having a camera? Did you take it all over with you?
No. Basically, I had an idea for a movie. I was just going to be the cinematographer and write the script, but because I didn't vote for the director's varsity show, he abandoned me, and I had to sort of make the movie myself. So I started at 116th Street and Broadway in the subway tunnel with Pan dancing out, and that was the beginning.
Did you start watching films shot by shot?
Well, it's kind of interesting because you sort of get it right away. I mean, that's what's interesting about talking to other directors. I mean, you know, you sort of immediately, it's like, you know, it's kind of a rarefied group of people because only few directors can understand what other directors are doing. So you're kind of... spend most of your time being misinterpreted or not interpreted at all, and only another director who has an acute sensibility like yourself can really sort of give you any kind of advice and suggestions about what you're doing with your work.
So who were the directors that you were able to communicate with?
Well, we had a whole group of them in the 70s, and we sort of kept close, but mostly, you know, Scorsese and Spielberg.
Mm-hmm. So you were all friends?
Mm-hmm. And still are.
Uh-huh. A lot of people have commented on the influence of Hitchcock on your work. What did you like about Hitchcock's vocabulary when you were starting to form your own?
We basically thought the same way. He thought in terms of images, and so did I. So it was like an immediate meeting of the minds. I immediately saw what he was doing and spent many years... learning all the things that he had developed. And then I sort of started to develop a vocabulary of my own.
When you started making movies, did you have a vision of what you wanted to do differently? Not just from Hitchcock, but I mean differently as a young director starting out wanting to make his mark.
Not really. You just sort of evolve. You have certain subject material that interests you. I started making sort of, you know, hippie, anti-establishment movies.
Like Greetings and Hi, Mom.
Yes, and then I spent, you know, a decade making thrillers because I wanted to learn about, you know, visual storytelling. And then I sort of got interested in a variety of different subjects, mainly that were driven by character and emotion.
Okay, thrillers. Now, why do thrillers lend themselves to visual storytelling more than other genres might?
Because you don't have to spend a lot of time with character development. All those scenes where people sit down and look earnestly into each other's eyes that you see on your soap operas every day are not required in thrillers.
And there's a lot of just like little visual details that can...
They're all driven by visual ideas, mm-hmm. You know. Finding something, following somebody, chasing after somebody, looking, observing. which are all things that are purely cinematic. Very difficult to do. Most directors don't have a clue about what it is, because most directors spend a lot of time just photographing scripts, which any clever Xerox machine can do. It doesn't take a lot of brains to put two people across from each other and have them talk to each other and take a two-shot. And then maybe an over-the-shoulder. And then another over-the-shoulder. Then they get up and walk out of the room. Directing.
I think Casualties of War is very much a character.
Yes, it is.
Oriented movie, and mm-hmm. it's stunning.
Yes.
Visually. Would you choose a scene from there that you'd want to describe, how you put it together to show, not action, but to show what was happening inside somebody?
Well, I thought that the way that the you finally show that all the guys raped the girl was done in a very elegant way, because it's done in a series of dissolves with the camera pulling back farther and farther and farther and farther. And then you realize, and then you cut to a close-up of Michael J. Fox, and you realize this is what he is watching. That's that big close-up with him, with the rain hitting him on the face, and you realize he's been watching these four guys, you know, rape this girl. And there's no sort of physicality to the rape. It's kind of like it's funereal is, I guess, the best way to describe it. And it's done in a series of very slow dissolves. And then you're brought to, where are we watching this from? We're witnessing this as he's witnessing it. And then you cut to this incredible close-up of his face, and you see his frustration and impotence that he can't do anything, and his sorrow. And I felt that worked very effectively.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian De Palma. His new movie is called Carlito's Way. It stars Al Pacino. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Brian De Palma is my guest. His new movie is called Carlito's Way. You once told Marcia Pally in an interview that you didn't like to see scary movies because being scared meant losing control, and being a director is about being the one in control. Was there a time when you felt you lost control as the director?
No, never. Oh, well, sometimes when you're doing an improvisation, and like in Be Black Baby and Hi Mom, where you've basically worked out a kind of open-ended improvisation, and what you're trying to capture is a kind of, documentary reality, and you basically just let the actors interact, and you just basically cover it like you would if you were a documentary filmmaker. And that did happen in Be Black Baby, and that was very exciting, where you don't know where it's going to explode. And it always surprises you, and that's what you catch on film, and it's as vivid to me now as it was then.
Is it true that you don't like to see scary films?
No.
No, you don't, or no, it's not true?
No, I don't like to see scary films. I don't like to be scared. Boo is something that I don't like.
And why not?
I'd rather be the puppet master than the puppet. I mean, who wouldn't?
As you became better known and started making more expensive movies and got deeper into the industry, did that bring more compromises you felt you had to make? Does one have to make more compromises as one gets deeper into the industry?
That is the age-old question.
I'm sorry.
I mean,
do we have to end the interview now? Was it really horrible?
The age-old question. I exposed myself to Julie Solomon for Bonfire of the Vanities precisely to answer these questions.
Yeah, well, I really admire you for allowing her to, you know, for opening up the door and allowing her to write that book. It's a fascinating book.
That's right, because you really try to show what happens as it happens and how these seemingly strange things occur on the screen that make no logical sense when you're looking at them for the first time.
Mm-hmm. And it's a book that really shows a lot of the frustrations in casting and shooting and budget that go on behind the scenes. Would you do it again? Would you let a journalist see everything that was involved in the making of a film again?
No, I think it's a one-time experience because a lot of people get their feelings hurt and there's no such thing as Hollywood reporting, really, because you're basically just being served publicity material to reprocess out into the media. Nobody really tells you exactly what's going on, and I guess the closest thing you get is gossip.
Is that why you felt it was a good idea to let her do it, so that there'd be a real report on her?
No, I thought the good idea, basically, because I would get questions about, well, do you have creative control over your casting, and how does the studio affect your work? And everybody I'd be talking to would seem like I was at an interview in 1930s while I was a contract director at MGM. It seemed to have no reality to the world I had been working in 20, 25 years. So that's why I let Julia board on Bonfire of the Vanity, so she could see what was going on. So maybe the journalists would read this book and maybe not ask these questions again. Now, to answer your question.
Yes.
Directors that have a certain track record, like myself, and, you know, Spielberg, Scorsese, Coppola, I mean, a bunch I can name, Sidney Pollack, they have a certain power because of the quality of the films they've made and the successful films they've made. So consequently, you are able to do pretty much what you want to do. Are you influenced by agents, producers, studio heads, marketing meetings? Sure. Do you have the ultimate say about everything that goes on the screen? Yes. So it's a sort of a process that works on you, but you are completely responsible for all of the decisions that go on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And and Bonfire of the Vanities is an excellent example in which I made a lot of decisions that, when I think about it now, I probably would have done differently, but I made all those decisions myself.
Mm-hmm. You were talking before about how thrillers have a lot of opportunity for visual storytelling. Is it the same way with violence, or do you find that violence lends itself to the kind of visual language you like to use?
Here we go again.
What did I do now?
I mean, here's a question I've answered for 25 years. The thing about violence in cinema is it's cinematic. That's why it appears in cinema. Now, of course, you can never defend violence because it's like defending wife beaters. I mean, you know, what can you say positively about violence? Violence is good. I like violence. You can't say any of these things without getting your head beaten to death. So consequently, I'll again say for the 9,000th time that violence is part of the palette of cinema. And that's why you see it in cinema. You can't see it on stage. Doesn't work too well. Doesn't work too well in music, doesn't work too well in painting, doesn't work too well in ballet. But on screen, it has a tremendous force. And it's specifically cinematic. So if you're making movies, you may move in the terrain of action and violence.
Film director Brian De Palma. His new movie is called Carlito's Way. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Jerry Stiller. In the first part of his career, Stiller was known for his comedy act with his wife, Ann Mira. In the past few years, he's been establishing himself as a comic actor in such films as Hairspray and The Pickle. Now he has a recurring role on Seinfeld as George's father. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us about Somalia's most respected form of communication, word of mouth. The Somali written language is only 20 years old. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The White House has tried to build on what it sees as a big win by Vice President Al Gore in his debate last night with Ross Perot. Mr. Clinton today held a news conference in order to praise Gore and declare that momentum in the NAFTA vote is going his way. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
President Clinton announced that five more lawmakers had announced they would vote for the North American Free Trade Agreement. The announcement was carefully timed to have the biggest impact and create a sense of momentum as the administration begins a frantic final push to find votes.
NAFTA means exports. Exports means jobs. No wealthy country in the world is growing more jobs without expanding exports.
The White House is still many votes away from the 218 it needs. Administration vote counters say they probably need about 20 more. Meanwhile, the leader of the opposition to NAFTA, Democratic Whip David Bonnier, announced he has already achieved his goal to get enough votes against the pact to kill it when it comes up for a vote in the House next Wednesday. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Capitol Hill, the House has passed the so-called Brady Bill that calls for a five-day waiting period for people trying to buy handguns. The vote approving the bill was 238 to 189 in favor of the measure that also calls for a background check on those buying handguns. The bill now goes on to the Senate, which will consider it after completing work on a large crime bill. President Clinton has said that he will sign the Brady measure if it passes Congress. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has fired two political appointees in his department. The two men were apparently involved in a search of personnel files of Bush administration officials and the leaking of information from those files. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The privacy of Bush administration employees may have been violated by the leaks, which first appeared in the Washington Post. Among other things, the Post said the file of Jennifer Fitzgerald, who had been a close aide to George Bush, was empty. The incident is doubly embarrassing for the Clinton administration because, as a candidate, Bill Clinton expressed outrage when his passport files were searched by Bush administration officials. The Inspector General investigated the latest file searches and briefed Secretary Christopher on his findings yesterday. Department spokesman Mike McCurry.
Based on this briefing, the Secretary immediately lost confidence in two employees of the department. He contacted the supervisors of these two and ordered that the two employees be dismissed immediately.
The employees are Mark Schulhoff and Joseph Tarver, who held mid-level jobs. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 23 points to close at 3,663.55 on volume of 283 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 11 to 9. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, three more children were killed today in Sarajevo, one day after shelling that killed at least nine people, including several children. As mourners buried their dead in the darkness, sniper fire could be heard in the capital. In yesterday's attack, students were killed as shelling occurred outside their school. It was the worst attack in the capital in weeks. UN officials said that yesterday's strikes appeared to come from an area where both Serbian and Bosnian troops are stationed. Meanwhile, movement of some 150 civilians from Sarajevo has been delayed by the government until tomorrow at the earliest. A study in this week's New England Journal of Medicine finds that much of the nation's milk supply is fortified with improper amounts of vitamin D, despite government efforts to address the problem. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
Dairies add vitamin D to milk because the nutrient can strengthen bones and prevent disease, but too much of the vitamin can cause health problems. 2 years ago, researchers discovered that milk sold in the eastern U.S. often contained far more or far less vitamin D than was claimed on the label. Federal and state officials said at the time they would work to solve the problem. But Boston University's Michael Hollick has conducted a larger follow-up study and found the situation as bad as ever.
No matter where the milk sample was purchased in the United States, basically the same problem existed.
A Food and Drug Administration spokesman expressed disappointment at the continued problem with vitamin D in milk. He said if dairies don't come into compliance soon, the FDA may take regulatory action against them. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
The government says the number of people filing new claims for jobless benefits moved up in the latest reporting period. The Labor Department says new jobless claims increased by 14,000 in the week ending November 6 to 354,000. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Fans of the Seinfeld show know that George recently moved back in with his parents because he couldn't afford his apartment anymore. That's good news for actor Jerry Stiller, who now has a recurring role as George's father. Back in the Ed Sullivan era, Jerry Stiller was best known as half of the comedy team Stiller and Mira, with his wife Ann Mira. The act played off what an improbable couple they made. He, short, schlumpy, Jewish. She, tall, attractive, Irish. Even people who missed their comedy act heard their Blue Nun wine radio commercials, which used the improv style they were known for. Stiller and Mira now have a video guide for aspiring actors called So You Want to Be an Actor. Well, here's Stiller in a recent episode of Seinfeld. George had landed a job as a model, a hand model, and he's home with his parents, pampering his hands.
I knew it. I always knew you had beautiful hands. I used to tell people, Frank, didn't I used to talk about his hands?
Who the hell did you ever mention his hands to?
I mentioned his hands to plenty of people.
You never mentioned it to me.
Hand me an emery board.
I always talk about your hands, how they're so soft and milky white.
No, you never said milky white.
I said milky white. Georgie, would you like some Jell-O?
Why'd you put the bananas in there?
George likes the bananas.
So let him have bananas on the side.
All right, please. Please, I cannot have this constant bickering. Stress is very damaging to the epidermis.
When you play George's father, do you think of yourself as playing your own father?
Yeah, in a way, it's all of the things that my father wanted me to do when I was just starting out as a teenager. When I told him I wanted to be an actor, for instance, there was a kind of a pallor that went over his face and a shock, because there was no understanding of what I was talking about. And that immediately put me in another position in terms of the way they looked at me, and they wanted me to go to work, for instance. That was something that was really onerous to me. Why should I go to work? I wanted to be an actor, you see. And George is very much the idealist. Whatever his loves and his thinking is, it's counteractive to his parents. And my father said, why don't you be a stagehand? That's like being on the stage. At least you'll be working every night.
Yeah, maybe it was easier for your father to understand the work of a stagehand than the work of an actor.
My father was a New York City bus driver. He's still around. He's 96 years old. And
Whoa.
My father was 5'3". He was probably the shortest bus driver in all of New York City. He was Jewish, which was not what most bus drivers were. And he had to put a Queens telephone book under his seat so he could see the road.
I had to do that when I started to drive.
So anyway, he
never
had...
Of course, I wasn't driving a bus.
Yeah, so the working aspect of life was very close to him. In other words, if you put in your 10, 12 hours a day, that meant you were worthy of something.
Mm-hmm.
I, of course, looked at it like, you know, my God, how could anybody want to do a thing like that for the rest of my life?
Now, in the movie The Pickle, which was directed by Paul Mazursky, about a film director played by Danny Aiello, you play Danny Aiello's agent. And it was fun to see you as an agent. And I was wondering if you could share with us any great agent stories from your life.
Well, there were times when we were starting out in the business, you used to make the rounds, you see. And rounds meant not only seeing agents, but also seeing producers. And there was one thing that I always dealt with. Somebody said to me, how do you deal with rejection? I said, the way I dealt with rejection very simply was I kept knocking on every door that I could, no matter what happens. And I always thought that if I got to see Lee Schubert, I would be able to get through and make my mark in this business. So believe it or not, I got to the Schubert office. I knocked on the door, and there the receptionist, Mitzi Heichos, I still remember her. I said, I'd like to see Mr. Schubert. She said, who shall I say is calling? I said, Jerry Stiller. And I knew that Lee Schubert had come from Syracuse, because I'd gone to Syracuse University, and the Schubert brothers were from Syracuse. She said, just a minute. She hit the intercom. She said, Mr. Stiller to see Mr. Lee. Send him right in. I walked in. I said, Mr. Schubert? He said, yes. I said, I'm Jerry Stiller. He said, yes. I said, I'm from Syracuse. He said, yes. I understand you and your brothers came from Syracuse. He said, yes. He said, what are you doing right now? I said, nothing. He says, when you're doing something, will you let me know? I said, yes. And I walked out of the office. I said, I just saw Lee Schubert. I couldn't get over the fact that I had made it in this business. So I was never afraid to knock on doors or talk to people.
It's like a vaudeville routine.
Yeah, it is a vaudeville thing. The other thing about the business and getting in to see people, there were agents who were very nice. There was an agent named Bill Liebling. Do you want to go on like this?
let me just ask you about the Schubert story. So when you got out of the office, and this was like your big brush with Mr. Schubert, did you say to yourself, well, wait, maybe I should have lied. Maybe I should have like puffed myself up a little bit more and taken advantage of the fact that I was in the office with him?
The man was so direct, you couldn't lie to him. He was looking right at your eye. And first of all, he was very small, and his head just came up over the edge of the desk. And you felt like it was a cannon being shot at you. He could tell a liar in 5 seconds. I couldn't go any further than that. So I went back to my regular job, which was serving hot dogs at Needick's and orange juice.
Now, this is the quintessential New York job, right? For people who don't know Needick's, which I guess many people do, it's a national chain now, isn't it?
Actually, it used to be a big chain. Needick's was located in Yankee Stadium. It was located in Grand Central. I worked a lot of Needick's. And the reason I worked Needick's was at 9 o'clock at night, I could get on the job, work till 6 in the morning, get a couple of hours sleep, then knock on the doors and make the rounds, as they call it.
My guest is Jerry Stiller. He now plays George's father on Seinfeld. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Actor Jerry Stiller is my guest. It seems to me you entered a new phase of your career when John Waters cast you as Divine's husband in the movie Hairspray.
Well, I had no idea that I would be playing opposite Divine as her husband Wilbur Turnblad and with Ricky Lake. But somebody called and said, do you want to be in one of the John Waters movies? I had never seen a John Waters movie, but I heard about John Waters, and they said, well, this was going to be a movie in which, you know, you could, you know, just be who you are. I says, well, all right. I took a wild shot, and I went down, and so there I was getting into makeup, doing the first day shooting, and there sitting next to me was Divine. And the first thing he said to me while he was putting on his makeup, he had his dress on. He had no wig. He looked at me and said, how's Anne? I said, she's fine. And a few minutes later, we were on a set shooting, and I was Wilbur Turnblad.
For any of our listeners who don't know Divine, Divine was an approximately 300-pound man who always played women, or usually played women, in John Waters movies. And I'm wondering if playing in John Waters' film changed the way people thought of you. I don't think you'd done too much acting before that. And it was such a fun, spirited movie, and everybody in your family in that film, Ricky Lake and Divine and yourself, were really... Very kind of like offbeat people, but you fell in love with all the characters.
Well, the shocker is that...
There was such nice people.
You're always shocked when people say, gee, I didn't know you did, you did movies or anything like that, because I had been doing it, but it's true. What happens is when you get into something that suddenly catches the public's fancy, and if you're lucky enough to be in a hit, and you don't know it's going to be a hit, something changes. You are recognized on the street. Like when I went to see Hairspray at the Lowe's 83rd Street in New York, I walked into the lobby, and the manager said, "You don't have to pay." Well, isn't that the thing that we all wanted when we were kids? You walk into the movies for nothing. Then when I went to go into the film house itself, the girl with the hot dogs gave me a free hot dog. And I had not seen the picture at all. I had not seen the movie, so I didn't know whether I was good in it, or I was medium in it, or whatever I was. So the shocker is to walk out of that place and then suddenly feel, well, you didn't know what you were going to get yourself into, but look how everybody treats you, you see?
Did you like it?
Oh, I loved it. Good. And then I went to see it again at the Waverly down on the Village, and that's where the people went nuts. In the lobby, I was besieged. I was there with Ann. People came up to me and they said, you're Wilbur Turnblad. You're Ricky Lake's father. And I had no idea it was going to turn out that way, really.
Was it hard for you to break out of the Stiller and Mira image years after you had stopped performing with your wife?
Well, we never really stopped. We still do it. But at the same time, we had come from, theater backgrounds. But the need to go on my own and Anne to do her thing alone really kind of came out of the fact that our kids were born, Amy and Ben, and suddenly here were a husband and wife working together, and suddenly you were being asked to play Las Vegas. Now, what do? You pick up the two children and the nanny, and you go to Vegas, and you get ready to do the nightclub act. I mean, it was easier for me because I'm the father and the man. He's supposed to be the breadwinner. But for the mom, how could you be a mother and a nightclub performer? You're working on new material, and your kids, where do you take the kids to school? So we made a kind of a concerted decision, which is very rare for both Anne and myself, to try to figure out a way to do everything. And one of the things that happened was that she got a job on Medical Center with Chad Everett, in which she was offered a major role, and I was in New York. And she said, "Can I do this, Jerry? Would you be upset if I went out and did this role?" I said, "You do it, and I'll be with the kids." And lo and behold, she got nominated for an Emmy for that role, and then suddenly we said, "Hey, we got a new career here, maybe for Anne." And the next couple of weeks, I was offered a role in The Ritz on Broadway with Rita Moreno and Jack Weston and F. Murray Abraham, my dear pal. And the show opens, and that becomes a hit. And I'll be damned if suddenly we say, hey, there's more to our lives than just doing the act. So we had the best of everything. Now we could set the kids off to school in New York. One of us will always be with them, or the two of us were with them. And it worked out that we were able to do the act later, too.
Now, you told us before that your father did not want you to become an actor. So when you found out that your son, Ben Stiller, wanted to go into show business himself, what was your reaction?
I had a kind of a knot in my stomach because Ben could name all the parts of the body in Latin when he was going to, literally in junior high school. And Amy was also kind of like caught up in this kind of, I guess it's academia. But what happened was both of them decided at one point that they were going to do it. Ben went to UCLA, and he dropped out after 9 months. He said, school doesn't give me what I thought I wanted. I wanted to be a film director. I said, you've got to go back to school. I'm not going to let you quit school. He says, why don't you come out here and go through class with me? So I went out to UCLA, and I sat through some of the classes. And I went into one of the lecture rooms. There was about 200 kids listening to a lecture. And I said, my God, I said, they're not getting one thing out of this. And I felt sorry for both the school and the kids because I said, how does anyone get through any of this? And he said, I'm going to go and become an actor and be a theater person on my own. I says, Ben, if you do, if you quit school, I'm really going to kick your butt. I don't use those words. But he said, Dad, trust me, I will do it all on my own. And would you believe for 2 years, he went to classes in New York, he studied, he cleared up his skin, which was full of acne, he went to the gym, he lost weight, he became an actor. And he eventually tried out for The House of Blue Leaves for John Guare, and he got the part, he appeared on Broadway. I used to come down, sneak in, see him in the second act. Went crazy watching him. I loved it. I went nuts every time he got applause. I says, gee, isn't it great? My kid's doing great. Meantime, Amy's working down at the 13th Street Playhouse off Broadway in some kind of a little Red Riding Hood thing, and I go down taking movies of her. So I was thrilled watching both of them go into it. But every time they came home and said, you know, I didn't get this, I didn't get that, I went nuts.
Yeah. Well, you and your wife, Ann Mira, have a new video called So You Want to Be an Actor.
That's right.
In which you and a lot of other actors give advice to would-be actors about how to break in. So let me ask you for some of the best advice, the best piece of advice you could give an aspiring actor.
I'd say find a good partner like an Ann Mira. there's a lot of things today that one can do. This thing of doing your own thing is very big today. Get your own material together. Work on that by yourself. Find a good teacher. Find someone you can really connect with. Also, just connect with other actors who are very helpful in keeping you alive, keeping you buoyant. People help each other in our business a lot. Anyway, that's enough of the plug, huh?
Okay. Jerry Stiller, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, and you're very kind.
Jerry Stiller co-stars on Seinfeld. Stiller and Mira's new videotape is called So You Want to Be an Actor. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, are you deconstructing last night's debate?
We are. We've asked a trade economist who's a supporter of the agreement and an economics writer who's against it to help us out with some of the facts that were in dispute last night. Some of the more irreconcilable statements of Vice President Gore and Ross Perot will be sorted out by our two guests. Also today, a story by Chitra Raghavan about a woman who has AIDS, a single mother, and what provisions she's made for her son after she goes. And we'll also talk with a former chief of Israeli military intelligence and a Palestinian political scientist who've been touring together about the future of the Israeli PLO agreement.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Most Americans now know where Somalia is and what some of its problems are, but few of us really understand how the way people communicate there affects what happens politically. Linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking about just that.
Until about 20 years ago, Somalia had a traditional oral culture. A small number of people were literate in Arabic, which was a liturgical language with something like the role of Latin in medieval Europe. But all discourse in the Somali language was carried out orally, in particular in the gabay, a form of poetry based on complex patterns of alliteration. Traditionally, the gabay is concerned with genealogy and the stories of clans and great battles, something like the chanson de geste of medieval France. But in the 20th century, it's become an important vehicle for political discussion as well. Each clan has its bards, people acknowledged as skillful composers of the gabay. And it's through the recitation of these poems that the clan leaders make their views on current events known to the people. Here's an example. This takes me to my old friend Francesco Antonucci, whom I ran into recently in France. In 1972, Antonucci headed up a group of Italian linguists and ethnographers who were asked by the military regime to develop a writing system for the Somali language. It was a difficult undertaking, both linguistically and politically. The mullahs objected to the impiety of writing in any language other than Arabic. And the team couldn't even use the Arabic alphabet for writing Somali, since it doesn't have any letters for vowels, and the Somali language has more than 20 distinct vowel sounds. Antonucci's team had to use the Roman alphabet. And this gave the mullahs further ammunition, since by a queer coincidence, the Somali word for the Roman alphabet is ladin, which also means without religion in Arabic. Nonetheless, the government persisted. In October of 1972, they clapped all the mullahs in jail and dropped the new alphabet on the people. I mean this quite literally. Army helicopters circled the cities and the oases and dropped leaflets containing primers, A for apple, and so on. At the same time, they instituted a system of universal primary education, set up printing presses, commissioned a dictionary, and so forth. The expectation was that within a decade or so, the political and cultural discourse of Somalia would all be carried out in writing, as it is in all the nations of what we call the developed world. It never happened. It's true that most people can read and write Somali a bit, and there are newspapers in the language, but the important political and cultural discussions are still conducted through the oral exchange of gabais. This doesn't have anything to do with technological or intellectual backwardness. Quite the contrary, it was technology that made writing unnecessary. By means of the cheap cassette recorders that are ubiquitous in Somalia, gabais are recorded, copied, and widely circulated from hand to hand or sold in market stalls. The cassette overcomes most of the limitations of oral culture. It's transmissible, storable, reducible, and so forth. And what's most important, it's a form that's universally accessible. Unlike a newspaper, say, it can't be controlled or closed down by the party in power. With the introduction of the cassette recorder, in fact, the gabai has become an even more versatile form than ever before through a kind of chaining process. One person writes a gabai, and another person adds a commentary or response that follows the same alliterative pattern. Ultimately, a set of cassettes may contain 30 or 40 poems on a single topic. Antonucci tells me that when he visits his Somali intellectual friends, he sees rows of cassettes on their shelves, along with books in English and Italian. The irony in all this is that Western diplomats and observers who are trying to get a handle on the political situation in Somalia tend to pay attention only to newspapers and written statements. Whereas Somalis refer to such statements as mere paper, using a word that also refers to excrement. Only when a leader puts his views in the form of an oral gabai does it carry any moral obligation. And this may be part of the reason why Western policy in Somalia has suffered from so many miscalculations and underestimations. We've been watching, but not listening.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University. He's now working in France. Our thanks to Francesco Antonucci for providing the goodbye tape that we heard. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Abby Fanta and Devin Reif are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services, 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This Veterans Day marks the 75th anniversary of the end of World War I. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with J.S. Cartier about photographing the bunkers, the trenches, the last vestiges of battle on the Western Front. Also, Irish journalist Tim Pat Coogan discusses the conflict that never ends in Northern Ireland. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.